From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and lots to cover today, much of which has to do with the coronavirus. But there's also some big political news today after last night's Big Tuesday results, which gave Joe Biden a commanding lead in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. He won at least 4 out of the 6 states to hold presidential primaries yesterday, including Michigan, a state where Bernie Sanders had staked much of his campaign. We haven't heard from Bernie Sanders yet, but we are expecting to hear from him this afternoon. We're joined now by NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, you and I were watching this all unfold together during special coverage last night. What do you think drove Biden's surge yesterday?
Democratic voters drove Biden's surge. You know, in my experience, usually a candidate heaves a crappy campaign over the finish line by dint of their own talents and grit and perseverance. That is not what happened yesterday. You know, Democratic voters propelled Biden's surge, not because someone knocked on their door and asked him to vote for them, because he had no field organization to speak of, not because they saw an ad about him on TV, because he had no money for ads until just very recently. Democratic voters are high information voters. They looked at Bernie Sanders. They looked at Joe Biden. They said Joe Biden is the better guy to beat Donald Trump. And the fact that Sanders did so much worse this year than 2016 suggests that a lot of his 2016 vote was an anti-Hillary vote. Hmm.
Sanders obviously did not have a good night last night. He has not made any comments yet. And some Democrats are saying this race is basically over at this point. We spoke with South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn last night, and here's what he had to say about Sanders staying in the race.
I think it is time for us to shut this primary down. It's time for us to cancel the rest of these debates, because you don't do anything but get yourself in trouble if you continue this contest.
What about that, Mara? And what are you expecting to hear from Sanders?
Well, Sanders will talk later today. There's a big debate about whether it's a good idea to stop everything now or not. Ro Khanna, the congressman from California, who's a big Bernie supporter, said today on CNN that Sanders should certainly stay in until the next debate. You know, sometimes pulling out too soon isn't good. In 2008, Hillary and Barack Obama went on and on and on. And even though it was a long slog, they laid down infrastructure in all those later primary states that helped them in the general election, helped Obama win in the general election. 2016, it was a little different. It was a more bitter primary. But I think the bigger question now, not so much as when does Sanders drop out, is how does Biden incorporate Bernie Sanders' passion? Last night, he did offer him an olive branch towards Bernie Sanders supporters. That's just a start. But how does he acknowledge that Sanders was onto something, that Sanders understood that young people need jobs that will allow them to pay for housing, health care, education, and retirement, or they need help from the government to pay for those things? So Biden needs to address that. He doesn't have to come up with the exact same solutions as Sanders, you know, government-run health care. But he has to address it in a meaningful way going forward.
But many of Sanders supporters are furious. They claim that the Democratic National Committee conspired against Sanders, tried to make it more difficult for him to get the nomination because they didn't think that he could win against President Trump. What have you been hearing from Sanders supporters?
Well, that's really interesting, because that was the argument last time that the DNC put a thumb on the scale for Clinton against Sanders. I'm not hearing as much of that from the Sanders campaign or from Sanders himself. You know, the DNC spent 4 years trying to convince Sanders that this time would be different. It wouldn't be rigged. It would be fair. And I do think this time there's no evidence that the DNC intervened. It seems like Sanders has lost these primaries fair and square. But yes, we do see from polling that large numbers of Sanders supporters say they will not vote for the Democratic nominee unless it's Sanders. So they're a little bit more resistant to coming together. I think the answer to that is the cue is people are going to take their cue from Bernie Sanders. Is he going to say it was a fair fight and he's ready to come together? He does say at every stop, I'll be there for Joe, and I know Joe will be there for me if I'm the nominee.
If Sanders stays in, the calendar doesn't look great for him. Next week, Illinois, Florida, Ohio, Georgia coming up the week after that. What are you seeing? And, you know, does Sanders have anything good on the calendar coming up?
Yes, it's hard to see a path ahead for him, given the states that you just listed, especially Florida, which is a very big state, not just big in terms of delegates for Democrats, but it's a battleground state for November that Democrats would really like to be competitive in. And his praise for Fidel Castro has caused a backlash among Democrats in Florida, not just Hispanic Democrats, but other Democrats. So he's way behind in the polls in Florida. Now, if we've learned anything in this primary, it's that there can be big unexpected curves in the road. So this race isn't done yet, but it is hard to see Sanders' path.
Mara, just briefly, how do you think coronavirus is affecting this race?
One way it's affecting it is that the candidates are canceling rallies. And also, it helps Joe Biden make the argument that at this time of crisis, we need calm, steady, serious presidential-style leadership. I think he's been helped by people's fear about corona. Big question, of course, is does President Trump decide to cancel some of his rallies?
Mm-hmm. That is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thanks.
Thank you.
Local health clinics will be at the forefront as that virus continues to spread in the United States, where there are now more than 1,000 confirmed cases. Dr. Ron Yee is chief medical officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers, which represents around 12,000 clinics across the country. Dr. Yee, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And your clinics are on the front lines, potentially, of this virus, but you also serve very vulnerable populations. How concerned are you as this virus spreads?
Yes, Peter. I think there's major concern for us, and it's mainly because these are populations, 29 million patients, 1 out of 12 Americans, that health centers serve already. We're on the front lines, and we take care of mainly underserved populations, including homeless people, a million agricultural farm workers, public housing people. We have about 48% have Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. We have 23% uninsured. So that concerns us because these are the populations that are mainly higher risk because of their living conditions, and many times their immune response is already compromised because of being homeless, being elderly, having chronic conditions. So this sets them up to be affected more than the general population.
And I would ask you whether any of those vulnerable people coming into your clinics have tested positive for the coronavirus, but the fact is you don't know because you don't have any tests. Is that right?
That's correct. And we've been following this very closely. Dr. Fauci from NIH on the weekend stated that we'd have about 4 million tests out in the field this week. So we've been following this very closely, been in contact with Quest Diagnostics and also LabCorp. And they stated that they would have many tests out in the field. So they're working through the details of what does that really look like on the front lines? How do we order the test? How do we get paid for it so that we can keep our businesses running? So, yes, that's the bottleneck right now.
And what's the consequence, in your opinion, of not having access to those tests?
So we lack specificity in terms of what we do on the front lines. So right now, we treat anybody that has flu symptoms the same way. The problem is that we don't know the specificity of who has what. So in general, we're still treating people the same way. We're taking care of them, giving them precautions, triaging them the same way. But there's a higher level of risk involved with coronavirus, and that's what we need help sorting through.
Has the government failed on this front, not getting those tests out there as quickly as possible?
I don't think I would call it a failure. I think it's more of a logistical challenge of really what does this look like and how do you make these things happen? And when you drill down to the front lines, that's where the challenge is how do you get this information into the electronic health record so we can use the right codes? How do you work with the laboratory to get that specificity of what you're trying to get? So to me, these are logistic things that we'll be working through the next few weeks as we get more information on how to handle these tests.
Look, big picture, I know one of the concerns around the world is that hospitals and clinics like the ones that you run will just not be able to keep up with demand if this virus continues to spread unchecked. Is demand an issue that keeps you up at night?
Yes, Peter, it is in a sense because the health centers, as they started with, they're so strategically placed around the country in every territory, D.C. and Puerto Rico. It's incumbent that we properly resource the health centers. So things like our long-term funding are really on the line, which we need from the federal government and Congress. we're in this reauthorization cycle where every 2 years we have to be reauthorized. And really it would help us dramatically if we could get long-term or permanent funding for the community health center program. And this is critical in these kind of responses. If the health centers are working right, we will keep a lot of people out of the emergency room and hospital. And that's where the big fear is. And that's where the big cost is.
And your clinics, I mean, right now, what are you seeing? Are they burdened yet?
It depends geographically, and we've been in contact with Asian Health Services in Oakland, California, and International Community Health Services in Washington, Seattle. They are getting pressed right now because of populations that travel more to some of these countries, especially China. And so they're having a higher level of fear in the community, and people are wanting to come in and call to be evaluated. So that's what's pressing us in terms of the personal protective equipment, staff time, and just flow in the health centers. But I think they're doing a good job in keeping up with it the best they can.
Dr. Ron Yee, Chief Medical Officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers, which represents 12,000 health clinics around the country. Dr. Yee, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
Let's take a break from the news of the day for a few minutes. Barry Sonnenfeld has a new memoir out this week. He's best known as the director of the Men in Black films, as well as 1991's The Addams Family, starring Angelica Houston and Raul Julia, who played the morbidly romantic couple Morticia and Gomez.
Look at her. I would die for her. I would kill for her. Either way, what bliss?
Barry Sonnenfeld's memoir is very funny, but it also touches on some painful issues like how he was molested by a relative. The book is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Barry, welcome.
Well, thank you, Jeremy.
And let's start with that title. You call it that because that actually happened to you at a concert at Madison Square Garden. Explain.
Yes. I was 17 years old. I was at the first Peace concert. Jimi Hendrix is warming up for the second time because he had stormed off earlier in the night. So he was in a bad place. And as he finally was ready to start his gig, over the PA system came the following announcement: Barry Sonnenfeld, call your mother. So, of course, I stand up immediately. I'm weeping because I assume my father has died and I'm going to have to live with my mother the rest of my life. And since I am standing, everyone knows I am Barry Sonnenfeld. So it starts in the cheap blue seats, the famous garden chant of Barry, Barry. It was horrible. So I called my mother, and of course, she somehow managed to get someone to answer the phone at the garden, convince them that this was an emergency. And the reason was I said I'd be home at 2, and it was 2:20. A.M.
Now, you also write that your mom did a lot of things that people would find a little strange. She would spit on a cloth and wipe your face with it, order you food even though it wasn't what you wanted. And when the two of you got in an argument, she would threaten to commit suicide.
Well, it wasn't so much argue. Yes, I became a senior in high school and prepared to go to college. She called it sleepaway school. And said that if I went away to college, sleepaway school, she would commit suicide. So I spent 3 years living at home. Yeah. And then when I was going to be a senior, I realized, wait, I can go away to another college and my mother commit suicide. Two birds, one stone. But she totally reneged on the offer. But I did spend my senior year at Hampshire College.
On a more serious note, though, there's a man in this book that you call Cousin Mike the Child Molester.
CM the CM.
A man who your parents had living in your apartment when you were a kid, even though you say they knew that he was molesting you.
Absolutely. And eventually, I confronted my father when he was in his 90s. I went up to the Upper West Side and sat with him, and I said, why did you let CM the CM live with us? And my father had three really interesting reasons. One, he said, don't forget child molestation didn't have the same stigma back then that it has now. Two, remember, your mother was very sad because of all the affairs I was having. So I thought she'd be happy having Mike around because he would drive her, you know, to the Paramus Park Mall and stuff. And the third reason ultimately was where my brain went tilt and I had to leave, which was when he said, besides, I never thought Mike was molesting you. I only thought he was playing with your penis. Hmm. So that's when you go tilt and you say, well, thanks, Dad. See ya.
Well, and the thing is that reading this book, you know, I sort of had a smile on my face the whole time. You're laughing, except for the parts that were about that. That's serious.
It is serious, but – and I don't want to make light of this or of my parents' decision to let this happen. But I will say I'm here with you now talking about a book, and I've had a successful life with a great wife and children. So, you know, I can't get too morose about it.
You say in this book that by all accounts you're one of the most neurotic people on the planet.
I'm very proud of that. In fact, both Larry David and I both worked with Cheryl Hines, who's a great actress, and we each wanted Cheryl to tell us that we were the most neurotic. And Cheryl didn't want to tell us because she knew whoever wasn't the most neurotic would be insulted. And she was on the Dave Letterman show one night, and she announced that I was the most neurotic person
oh, wow.
she had ever met.
So
years later, I was at a power breakfast place in Manhattan. And from across the room, I hear Larry David's voice screaming, Sonnenfeld, you claim you're more neurotic than me, but you're eating eggs with yolks, you're putting butter on your bread, and you're eating bacon. And I yelled out, extra crispy. So I won that one.
How does being neurotic feed into the successful film career that you have had?
I feel that it has given me a quirky attitude towards life and towards movies. You know, the movies I tend to do, Adam's Family, the Men in Black movies, are all about lighthearted, dark issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been my sort of viewpoint on life. You know, things are dark, but let's sort of have fun.
It was almost accidental the way you got into the film business.
Yeah, I went to NYU Graduate Film School literally only because it kept me out of the job market for three additional years. I had no interest in film. I wanted to be a still photographer but didn't want to be alone so much. And so at film school, I realized I kind of was good at cinematography. And when I got out of school, I felt that if I owned a camera, I could call myself a cameraman without being a dilettante. And one night I was at a party where everyone was from Darien, Connecticut, except one other Jewish guy across the room. We started to talk. It was Joel Cohen
of the Cohen brothers.
Right. Joel and Ethan had just written the script for their first movie, Blood Simple, and were going to shoot a trailer and use that trailer to raise the $750,000 to make the movie. So I said, I own a camera, and he said, you're hired.
Mm-hmm.
So we shot the trailer. We got along really well. I helped them raise the money. It took a year. And the first day on the set of Blood Simple was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a movie set.
You became a director on the first Addams Family movie.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, I was in L.A., and my wife and I were in bed watching the Indianapolis 500, of all things. And the front desk called up and said, Scott Rudin, who's a famous movie producer, has left a script for you. He wants you to meet him in 2 hours at Hugo's, which is a local L.A. Mm-hmm. hangout. So I read the script. And of all the scripts to be sent to me, it was kind of the perfect one because Charles Addams, A, is a very dark visual cartoonist. B, I grew up with his cartoons and I loved them. I didn't like the script. I went to Scott. I went to Hugo's and said, why me? And he told me that he had gone to Tim Burton and Terry Gilliam. They had both passed. And he said, since all the good directors passed, I thought I'd offer it to you.
I want to go back to your personal life, because you make clear in this book the love and devotion you have in your wife, Susan, who you call sweetie.
That's right.
Do you think that that difficult relationship with your mother affected your ability to have a healthy love life and a long relationship with your wife?
Well, I have to say, Jeremy, that's an incredibly good question, because sweetie was very nervous to marry me. And the reason was because she thought I had no good role models. And she was concerned that I would have no idea how to be a good, loving husband. But I proved her wrong, and she's still sweetie, and we've been married for 31 years and very, very happy.
And your parents?
Thank God they're dead.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, you two are parents.
Oops. Did I say that out loud? Sorry. Yes, and the challenge of being a parent is not to be like what your parents were, yet you become what your parents were. You know, I became my mother and my father. I'm like my father, who was a salesman, and, you know, I'm always telling people what to do. And I have my mother's fears and worries. You know, when my daughter flies, I'll stay up all night looking at FlightAware and go, wow, why did her plane just go from 34,000 feet to 33,900? What's going on?
Well, you were in a plane crash, we should say. You were in a plane crash in your life.
Yes, I was. And, you know, the story sounds so unbelievable that I actually, at the end of the chapter, publish the NTSB's transcript of the black box, where you hear the co-pilot say things like, yee-haw, and I don't think we're going to make it.
God. What is your biggest piece of advice if there is another young Barry Sonnenfeld to be out there?
That's easy. You know, at the end of the book, I mentioned that Will Smith wanted to take me to underprivileged schools in Philly, where he grew up, and say, if this guy can direct big budget movies with movie stars, anyone can. And I think that would be my piece of advice, which is that if I can do it, anyone can. And figure out what you want to do in life that will give you joy, and you will somehow find a way to make a living doing it.
That is Barry Sonnenfeld, whose memoir is called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Few industries have seen more of an immediate effect from the coronavirus than the airline industry. Delta, American, and United all cutting back on the number of domestic and international flights as bookings decline. United says ticket sales have fallen 25%. Delta says bookings have dropped 25 to 30% over the past 2 weeks. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan here, now transportation analyst. Seth, I was just on a plane this morning. There were 8 passengers on my flight, the entire plane almost empty. How much trouble are the airlines in?
Jeremy, that sounds like a post 9/11 era flight. Mm-hmm. And not all flights are that empty. I talked to somebody else who was on a flight yesterday who estimated it was maybe 40 to 50% full. But obviously what has changed here is, whereas a week ago we said there was kind of a dichotomy. People were still flying, they just weren't booking. Now, at least a lot of people aren't flying. And the difference between this and 9/11, Jeremy, is that back then, you know, I remember flying around on these very cheap fares that were available, empty flights, and thinking, I know I'm perfectly safe, probably the safest I've ever been because of all the new measures. This is a little different. Most of us are not going to die from coronavirus, but this is an ongoing threat, and you can't exactly tell people there's nothing to worry about when there are people out there contracting and in some cases dying from coronavirus.
So what are the airlines to do about this? We know that the heads of United and Southwest say they're going to forego base salaries until the end of June and take pay cuts. Some airlines are halting hiring. They're cutting capacity. What are they doing?
Yeah, the CEO of Southwest actually said in a video posted for employees yesterday that those maxes that Southwest was desperately awaiting not too long ago. Once they are ready for delivery, you know, who knows if Southwest really wants them immediately, even though in the long term, there's no question they do. These airlines in another era would already be furloughing employees, Jeremy, with the kinds of capacity cuts that we're seeing. The U.S. airlines, very different from some around the world that have literally been going out of business in recent weeks, the U.S. airlines came into this crisis in a relatively healthy state. And so you can kind of see them balancing short-term versus long-term, you know, as you said, pausing hiring, offering some voluntary leave, that kind of thing, thinking, you know, if this is just a 2-3-4 month problem, we, you know, they're thinking you're all going to be okay and don't want to anger the employees going into, you know, the next round of labor negotiations and all of that. That's a luxury they have right now. The problem is that nobody knows exactly how long this will last.
Do you think a bailout is likely from the federal government?
That's been dangled, and we'll see. Again, you kind of have to walk the line here. Usually a bailout, like the one that came after 9/11, is when an industry can credibly say, look, if we don't get this, who knows if we're going to be able to stay in business. That's not yet the case here, but these airlines, I mean, this is already a recession in the travel industry, right? The rest of the economy, we'll see. It's clearly shaky, but airlines are in a recession. That much they can certainly say.
Do you think that we're going to see airlines go out of business because of this?
U.S. airlines, probably not, unless, you know, there's some kind of worst case scenario here. And I mean, let's be honest, this has all gotten worse than most of us imagine. The, sort of that range of possibilities keeps sliding over. But right now, would still say that these airlines are most likely to be fine when you see travel already rebounding domestically within China, for example, even though the threat hasn't passed. So a lot of scenarios where things can be okay, either because the virus itself subsides as a threat as the summer approaches, or people just go back to traveling, but no certainty yet.
Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Let's take another look at the state of the 2020 race after yesterday's voting. Joe Biden again found overwhelming support among black voters in Mississippi and also in the battleground state of Michigan. And that is raising new questions today about the viability of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Joining us now is the civil rights activist and two-time presidential candidate himself, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He endorsed Sanders on Sunday. Reverend, welcome. What do you think? Is it time for Sanders to suspend his campaign?
That's his decision to make. But let me submit to you that there's a debate coming Saturday night. California's not coming yet. He's leading California. I don't know, perhaps Washington. So it may be closer than it appears to be.
Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders both are two men that you actually know quite well. In your presidential bid in 1988, you ran against Biden in the primary. Sanders happened to endorse you in that race. You have said that while Biden is a decent man, Sanders is the moral center of the Democratic Party. But why do you think the majority of black voters who voted so far do not see these two men the same way that you do?
Many people are voting for Biden running from Trump. Many people voting for Mr. Biden do not know him nor his record. For example, the people who support Biden, they would not support his crime bill, locked up all these children without a chance for redemption, and making busing illegal as a tool to desegregate schools. A lot they don't know, but they will know. The people that Bernie has inspired, young America, must not be marginalized. They must know they have power. They can make America better for everybody and for our future.
Well, Reverend, you are right. Bernie Sanders has inspired younger voters. They have backed him by a lot in the primary election. On the other hand, they also have not come out in very great numbers, especially compared to 2016. How do you explain that? If he is going to rely on those young voters to win.
That's prevailing wind that says beat Trump at all costs. And Biden is the only one can win. And that wind blows across the country. I submit to you, however, the absence of Trump is not the presence of justice. We still need a comprehensive health care bill. We need a civil rights commission revived. We need a black woman on the ticket and on the Supreme Court. So if we're going to be fair about it, let's be inclusive.
I've heard you say you will support Joe Biden if he is the Democratic nominee. But what about the rest of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party? Will they come along?
Well, it seems to me that it becomes our obligation that Biden-Sanders is an inter-squad struggle. Two players on the same team playing each other. You go to Milwaukee, two streams come together and make for a big river. And that's time to make the big transition from Milwaukee to November. And that can happen. For example, Lyndon Johnson was very disliked. People were afraid of Lyndon Johnson, given his civil rights record. He redeemed himself. He became the most progressive civil rights president. Abraham Lincoln only didn't compare with Lyndon Johnson. But he redeemed himself with war on poverty and health care and a number of provisions.
You're saying Joe Biden could come along in the same way?
Yeah. I think that Biden's emphasis on decency and honor. At this time, kind of like Jimmy Carter after Nixon, decency and honor become real currency.
That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Let's bring in Eddie Glaude now, an African-American studies professor at Princeton University. Professor, welcome to you.
It's my pleasure.
And what's your takeaway from Joe Biden's strong showing again last night?
You know, I think it's a combination of the particular electoral environment. You know, this is not a race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but a race between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Donald Trump. That difference matters. I think the electorate is kind of motivated by the overarching concern of getting Trump out of office. And the idea of taking a chance on a revolutionary agenda in this context, I think, has people a bit nervous. And then, of course, there are just those folks who support the political positions of Biden. So he's been able to build a coalition of white suburban women, older voters, older white voters, and African-American voters, older African-American voters. And we're seeing the turnout in his favor. So I think it's pretty clear where the electorate is going, the Democratic electorate is going.
The turnout in Joe Biden's favor is better than what it was in 2016. He's outperforming what Hillary Clinton did, according to the numbers. Do you think that that bodes well for the general election if he is, in fact, the nominee?
Sure. I mean, political scientists have been talking about this for a while, that we were on the precipice of a historic turnout. We saw this in 2018 in the midterms, right? And in some ways, that blue wave that gave Nancy Pelosi the gavel has evidenced itself once again in the Democratic primary. So I think more than anything, this is more about anti-Trump than it is about excitement around the Biden campaign. He's benefiting from it. And I think We all need to understand that as we move forward.
Well, in fact, some progressives are making that point. They're saying that 2020 is not a season of hope, but in fact, it is a season of fear of losing the White House again to Donald Trump. And now that we've seen some of these elections playing out, I mean, what do you think of that idea? Is that still valid?
I think so. You know, I think, look, when Bernie Sanders came out of Iowa and New Hampshire, there was almost a full-blown panic among those who were moderate and conservative Democrats, or we might even call them corporate Democrats. There was this cry from the Beltway that we had to save the party from Sanders and his communist, quote-unquote, as Bloomberg described him, ilk. And so there was this kind of politics of fear around the social revolution as Sanders described his agenda and what it would mean for the country. And so there was, I think, a mobilization of fear and panic and a consolidation around that has in some ways oriented a large segment of the Democratic Party. Again, that's not to say that there aren't folks out there who agree with Biden, but I would want to say that, you know, we know, I mean, de Tocqueville and Hobbes and even Machiavelli talked about the importance of fear in our politics, and we saw it deployed very clearly in the primary as we were coming out of New Hampshire into South Carolina. And I think that fear played a significant role in the momentum that we're experiencing now with Vice President Biden.
I'm looking at some of the exit polls from last night in Michigan. Joe Biden won black voters by a 2-3 margin. And we just heard Jesse Jackson say that Bernie Sanders has the right to stay in this race. But what do last night's numbers tell us about that?
You know, I was really looking closely at those numbers because I wanted to see whether or not the support for Biden was basically regional, that it was Southern. But what we see in Detroit, and we saw it in Missouri and elsewhere, is that black voters have made their choice. They are, in some ways, choosing the person that they think can beat Donald Trump. Mm. Some of them, of course, agree with Biden, but for the most part, I think this reflects a substantive judgment that this is the best chance to get rid of the man in the White House. Now, whether this means that Sanders should step aside, I don't think that think we should make that judgment now. What we need to do is wait till Sunday.
The debate, right.
And see how that goes, right? We have to see how Biden responds in real time to a progressive agenda that confronts his voting record. And we need to understand what that is. We need to understand what we're choosing.
What will the eventual nominee need to do to make sure that black voters show up for the general election?
You know, I think we're going to show up no matter what, right? I think Biden's going to have to put forward, I think, a clearly stated agenda where he's going to have to commit, as he's already, I think he's already committed to appointing a woman, a black woman, to the Supreme Court. I think he has to have, he has to choose a VP that's going to excite the base. Could it be Stacey Abrams? I don't know. But it has to be someone who's not just simply center-right. It has to be someone that is that makes the progressive wing of the party excited. We don't want to make the Tim Kaine mistake again, right? I think also we need to see a clear agenda around criminal justice, a clear agenda around housing, a clear agenda around the labor market and employment, right? Specifically talking to black folk, right? That is to say, we just can't give him our support because he knows us, right? We need to see something. We need a firewall for black people, as Reverend Jackson would say. So I think we're going to see those numbers. We just need to continue to press whomever's the nominee for a clear agenda for black America.
That's Princeton University African-American Studies Professor Eddie Glaude. Eddie, thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you.
The coronavirus has already had a major impact on the entertainment industry. Movies like Peter Rabbit 2 and the latest James Bond film, No Time to Die, which were due to open in the next month, have had their openings delayed. The Coachella Music Festival is also postponed until October, and there may be more to come. Joining us now to talk about the turmoil in Hollywood over COVID-19 is John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame. Hi, John.
Hey there.
So films moving their premiere dates just a few weeks before they're supposed to premiere, it sounds pretty drastic. Is this unprecedented?
It is in my memory, and I think we're pretty early into the story so far. So let me just give you some numbers right now, and it's really about the kind of global marketplace for the movie business. Last year, ticket sales outside the United States were $30.8 billion, which is almost triple what they were in North America, United States and Canada. And here are the top three markets outside the United States. China, last year, $9.3 billion. Japan, $2.4 billion. South Korea, $1.6 billion. So all of those markets are either essentially closed or empty right now. And the most conservative estimates I've seen is that that means the U.S. studios have lost about $2 billion in box office revenues, and that could get higher because movies either aren't coming out or they're coming out and nobody is going to see movies outside the country.
So we talked about those two movies that have moved back their premiere date. Is anybody going to be coming out with movies in the meantime?
Certainly movies are going to come out in the States, and for the time being, I mean, we'll see how long that lasts. The real question is, if you can't get an international release date, I mean, 70,000 theaters in China are closed, then you're really not that smart releasing your film in the States alone. So there's films like Mulan. We talked about the James Bond movie. If you can't get anybody to go see them outside the United States, then you're really kind of wasting money.
Do you expect U.S. theaters to start closing?
I think that's really the next question. I mean, I think people are really starting to reconsider what it means to be out in public with a lot of other people. And I think that's why you've seen things like the Coachella Music Festival, South by Southwest cancel. It's not just that, you know, people who are coming, companies, musical artists, films, that they're nervous about coming. It's about the guests and the spectators. Would you want to go to Coachella and be with a quarter of a million other people in close proximity? The answer is no. And would you want to go to a movie theater, even if it's relatively safe?
Anyone who's ever seen the end of a movie in the credits knows how many people go into making a movie. What are the knock-on effects of all of this for the industry in general? I imagine that stars are not traveling around to their premieres at the moment. And of course, there are all those people behind the scenes who make these movies happen.
I think that's a really good question. So when a movie comes to town, let's just make up a number and say it's a $10 million budgeted film. It's not just that $10 million. It's the people who are coming to town, who are going to restaurants, who are renting cars, hotel rooms. So if you cancel a movie, you cancel a festival, it's not just, you know, the ticket sales and the paychecks. It's all of the other money that's spent in and around an event or a production like that.
John, are there any winners in this? And by that, I mean companies that offer streaming, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Roku. People are going to be in their houses more often. They're going to be watching those kinds of things.
I think absolutely. And if you look at the performance of certain stocks, you would see that Netflix, compared to the overall market, is up 25%. Compared to the broader market overall. And then if you look at Netflix compared to, say, the Walt Disney Company, it's doing 40% better. So at least in terms of how Wall Street is judging the prospects of these companies, certainly, you know, investors are saying streaming seems like a much better play than a company that's running, you know, cruise ships and theme parks.
John, one more thing, and it's kind of incredible that I'm asking you this question last, and it just goes to show how important the coronavirus is in terms of its impact on Hollywood. But we got a sentence today for Harvey Weinstein, 23 years in prison after being convicted of two felony sex crimes. Are you surprised by the severity of that verdict?
It's certainly very close to the high end of the sentencing guideline range. Harvey Weinstein's defense lawyers had argued for something closer to 5 years. And I think what's important to remember is that this is based on essentially the rape and assault of two women. But the judge and everybody else knows there are dozens and scores of other victims of Harvey Weinstein. And while he was not convicted for assaulting those other women, it was factored into his sentence. I think it's a stunning verdict. And I think we also have to stop and remember the women who testified against them. These women felt threatened. I think he threatened them, and they knew their careers might be over if they talked. And they were very brave to confront Harvey Weinstein, and he would not be behind bars for 20 years had they not come forward.
That is John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Really says something about how much news is going on, Peter, when a sentence like that for Harvey Weinstein is almost an afterthought today. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
The U.S. started withdrawing troops from Afghanistan this week, the pullout part of a deal Washington signed with the Taliban last month aimed at ending America's longest war. We'll speak with an Army veteran who served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, and of course we'll have the latest on COVID-19. That's next time on Here and Now.